This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The saga of Ryan White is one most people over 40 know well. The Indiana teenager with AIDS who just wanted to go to school. The media coverage that shared his story with the world showed a nation coming to terms with the fact that this once polarizing disease could, in fact, happen to anyone. Now, more than 29 years after his death, PBS's Retro Report is re-examining the AIDS crisis of the 1980s with a focus on Ryan White's story. Joining us today is the producer of that piece for Retro Report, Meryl Agish. Meryl, hello.
Hi, nice to be with you.
And also on the phone is the mother of Ryan White, Jeannie White-Ginder. Jeannie, thanks and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
And if you have questions for Meryl or Jeannie, or if you want to share your recollections of that time, please do so on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. First of all, Jeannie, we just missed you. You were in Indianapolis last week giving talks at the Children's Museum. What were you doing there?
Ryan has an exhibit there. It's called The Power of Children, and it features Anne Frank, Ruby Bridges, and Ryan White. And it's about kids who face discrimination, fear, and panic, and so forth.
And what do you share when you do talks like that in person?
Well, the Children's Museum is geared towards middle school kids, this exhibit is, and so I speak in Ryan's room. I just tell Ryan's story for about 30 minutes. I just explain Ryan's story and point out different items in the room. His bedroom is featured in its entirety, just like it was when Ryan passed away. And it was quite a large room, so it's quite a storytelling exhibit, really.
And this exhibit opened a number of years ago, but it was still more than 15 years after you lost Ryan. What was it like to gather all those belongings, his bedroom? It must have been nice to know that what they were going toward, but was that part difficult, too?
Well, I tell you what, my husband and I and my daughter, we were moving to Florida. And we kept the house in Indiana for a couple years, and I didn't want to tear it down because I knew it would never be the same. And so I called some of the museums, and I happened to call the Children's Museum, and they said, can we come out and look at it? Well, they were amazed. They came out and looked at it, and they could not believe it was in its entirety, you know, just like, and they said, we want it all. They said, we want to do something focusing on bullying because that is a big topic for today, and with the discrimination and you know, that everybody faces. And it was just something I said, oh, my gosh, I could not believe it. They took the dimensions of his room, and so they actually created his room exactly like it was.
And this exhibit opened in 2007?
Yes.
And what was it like for you to see it for the first time, sort of reproduced and in a place where it was meant to be seen by other people?
Well, you know, you're involved with the project, but at the same time, it's nothing like when you actually see it. And I can, I knew I would be amazed, and I hoped that they were going to do exactly the way they said they would, and they did. But my daughter at the grand opening, she said, Mom, it's 10 times better than I ever thought it would be. And so that just made me, you know, because I wanted her to be pleased. She was so much left out of the story, but lived every day of it just like we did. And so just for her to be happy. And they included her in so much of the out exhibits, too. On the outside of the room, there's a TV studio where kids can be an anchor person, and they could be a cameraman, and you push a little button, and you push that button, and it asks questions. It tells the kids to ask a question, and then Ryan comes on behind you and answers the question. So it's just kind of, you know, it's an all-around. It features Andrea. It features a lot of Ryan's friends, especially the friends that were welcoming him. And also the locker, that, you know, he had a very bad locker experience where he called me one day from school and he said, Mom, I'm not sure what to do. And he had handled himself so great with everybody by that time. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, well, when I got to school, the outside of my locker was marked bag and other things. And he said, somebody's been in my locker because all my books and folders had bag wrote on them. So, I mean, it's just a great, great teaching tool, I think, to show the discrimination that people with AIDS faced at that time. people thinking that you had to do something bad or wrong or you wouldn't get the disease. And you try to explain to people that he got it from his factor used to treat his hemophilia, his medicine, and people didn't want to hear that. You know, this, a lot of people thought this is God's punishment for people who do bad things. And somehow, some way, he's done something he shouldn't have or he wouldn't have got it. And that was a most horrible thing for her to have to try to explain to people that anybody can get this disease.
We're talking with Jeannie White-Ginder, the mother of Ryan White. So when you give talks like this, like the ones that you gave last week at the Children's Museum and others that you've given across the country, and you talk to kids like you did last week, have you gotten any good questions from them that sort of stick in your mind?
Oh, my gosh. At this time, I mean, a lot of the parents that are Ryan's age now are bringing their kids. So it's a whole new group of people being educated on Ryan and the toys and so forth, the same items like that Ryan had in his room. And, oh, yeah, I mean, the kids are just fascinating. And, you know, and they're always kind of sad, too. You know, they quite don't understand death. And so, they always ask me how, you know, where's Ryan at now? And I'll say he's in heaven. You know, he got very sick and he got a disease and he couldn't fight it no more. You know, it attacked his whole immune system. So, I mean, but most of the kids are just like, you know, oh my gosh, he has taught me so much. I did a project on him. You know, we had a wax museum at school and I was Ryan, you know, and especially the National History Day projects. I have so many and kids giving book reports on Ryan and saying, you know, oh gosh, I've learned so much. And a lot of kids, a lot of Ryan's mail, they also have a mail. They a whole bunch of letters that were wrote when Ryan was younger. They've contacted the same people and asked them, talk to them. And it's been a hard project, but ask kids, you know, what it was about Ryan that helped, why they wrote to Ryan. And it's kind of strange to hear some of the kids because the kid said, you know, he taught me how to be better than myself, and he taught me not to feel sorry for myself. A lot of handicapped kids wrote Ryan, and they would say, you know, that he helped me. You know, we were dealing with the same thing with school kids making fun of me and so forth. So it's a big variety of kids who feel like they're in despair that, you know, especially Ryan came from a single home and his dad was an alcoholic. Well, you know, a lot of kids can relate to that. And Ryan used to say, well, as long as you have one good parent, you're doing pretty good. So I just think it's a teaching, but also somebody that they can relate to that's in the public eye.
Are you going to be back to Indiana anytime soon?
Well, thanks to Elton John. Elton John gives the Children's Museum a grant every year. And this year he signed it for 5 years. So it brings me back 4 times. I'm there for 3 days. And my daughter in July, she comes with me. She's a school teacher in Florida here. She teaches 8th grade. And so, yeah, we will be back. We, you know, at least for the next 5 years, so forth. But I get to come back. I speak a lot in Indiana. So different events and different organizations, the Hemophilia, Indiana Hemophilia Foundation. And so I do events with them too. So I get back quite a bit.
Well, I've got more questions about Elton John, but we'll save those for later. Meryl, I want to get to you. Your piece for Retro Report airs tonight on PBS. How familiar were you with the Ryan White story before you started working on this?
Well, excuse me. You know, I knew about Ryan White because he is just such an iconic figure in that early, you know, the early decade of the AIDS crisis and the HIV epidemic. But, you know, I was born in the early 80s, so it was I'm a little bit younger than he would have been. And he was just a person that I always knew about, and I knew his significance. But it wasn't until really researching this piece that I really came to understand, you know, how transformative he was as a cultural figure, as a, you know, a young person who seemed to really captivate, you know, all of the country. And when you look at the news coverage, his story was playing out, you know, on a really regular basis. It was a regular feature of the nightly news. And I think that I didn't fully appreciate because I, you know, I wasn't watching the evening news at that time. But to really see how deeply covered his story was. And, you know, for, I'm sure, positive and negative effect, as Jeannie, I'm sure, can describe, that there was just so much attention paid to him. And I think he really helped change the conversation around HIV and AIDS in this country, because there was just so little known at the time that he was, you know, he was alive.
Yeah, you uncovered how even certain medical personnel didn't know the proper protocol for containing the virus. Some people thought it could be airborne, and that caused concerns that were unfounded. How much did Ryan really help to inform people?
Well, I think, you know, I spoke with Dr. Elaine Cox, who's the medical director at Riley Children's Hospital. And, you know, unfortunately, her interview didn't make it into the piece. Ultimately, we have plans for that for a future piece. But, you know, she at the time was talking about how a lot of people just didn't know, and the medical community maybe overreacted a bit, even that there was a little bit known about methods of transmission. But, you know, to be extra safe, to be extra cautious, there were some extreme measures taken. And I think there's a clip from her interview that speaks to that.
All right, let's hear that.
And then it was, you know, we gowned and gloved when we saw these patients, and there were all kinds of images that maybe we had very good other reasons other than they just had HIV, but people were afraid. And so when I came into practice, I would get calls all the time from people saying, there's a child who's coming to my office who's HIV positive. Should we wear gowns and gloves? Do we need to bring them in the back door? How do we fumigate the room after they're there? People were so afraid of that piece, they couldn't get past that. And so for a child like Ryan, who wanted to go to school, if you think that merely touching someone or breathing the air that they've breathed is going to give you a disease that's got horrible, ravaging images on the news every night and for which there is no cure, it quickly goes from fear to panic.
Wow. We've only got about 30 seconds left. And as best I can tell, today doesn't really mark any kind of anniversary, the 30th anniversary of his death and the signing of the Ryan White Care Act next year. Why share this story now?
Well, I was looking for a way to connect some of the themes in Ryan's life to where we are today. And I think the lasting stigma, you know, is really very prevalent still across the country. And we've made tremendous medical progress, but we as a, you know, as a culture still have not fully made it yet.
Today, we're exploring the legacy of Ryan White with his mother, Jeannie White-Ginder, and producer Meryl Aguish from PBS's Retro Report, and we'll take your questions and comments. What do you remember about the media coverage in the 80s? I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds, and this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to today's show on the legacy of Ryan White, yesterday, we spent some time catching up on last week's disciplinary hearing regarding sexual misconduct allegations against Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. We got the scoop from two State House reporters, our own Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting and Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. You can find that wherever you get podcasts. Back now with producer Meryl Aguish from PBS's Retro Report and Jeannie White-Ginder, the mother of Ryan White, the Indiana teenager who helped shift the way Americans viewed the AIDS epidemic shortly after its onset in the 80s. And let us know what you remember from that time, or if that was before your time, when did you first hear about Ryan White? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Jeannie, Rhonda on Facebook just shared something nice. Thank you. Thank you, Jeannie, for your heartfelt interview. I can feel the love and joy in your voice for Ryan's story. He was a brave young man. What strikes me, Jeannie, and I think most people about this story, is just the resilience of not only Ryan, which to me is a whole different, almost inexplicable class unto itself. I mean, at that age, to have the guts to stand up against all these angry adults who don't know any better and to be thrust into the limelight and handle it the way he did. I mean, that's a lot of the reason we're here talking today. But your resilience as well, you also weren't afraid to seize that moment. I know it was a long time ago, and it's been your whole life since then. But do you remember what it was like for you at the time to suddenly be put on that pedestal?
Oh, wow. You know, it was something I wasn't prepared for. I mean, this story kind of broke overnight. People say, why did you go public? Well, we never went public, but I didn't really think to hide it either. It was a, you know, the they didn't give Ryan's name, but a local Howard County youth been diagnosed with AIDS, and everybody just kind of knew then it was Ryan. He was the one that was very sick. But, you know, I didn't take it as well as Ryan did. You know, I just wanted to let him live his life to the fullest, no matter how long he had. And he was only supposed to live 3 to 6 months. And, you know, the media, though, picked up on Ryan's story. And the media gets a lot of discredit for a lot of things, or, you know, but the media was Ryan's best friend because they got his message and story out. And I say that because it helped the education process. And I would be so upset with things people were saying. And Ryan was always telling me, Mom, just be my mom. You'll be okay. Mom, they're just trying to educate their own kids like you're trying to educate me. He said, when you don't know about something, you're going to be afraid of it. That's why we have to continue. But it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy for me. I was upset a lot, and Ryan was always telling me to keep my chin up. And I would question Ryan, are you sure you really want to go do through all this? And he would say, yes, I want to go back to school. So that gave him hope. But I think that fight to go to school, I think it helped him to live. It gave him something to fight for.
A question from Zachary on Facebook. Have you met many people who were privately empathetic toward you and your son, but publicly condoning the harassment? He continues, I'm sorry that you had to go through such a horrible situation. No parent should have to bury their child. What about that?
You hear from all different kinds of people. I mean, with people thought that with what they knew at the time, they felt like they were doing the right thing. And then other people said it became so ugly, you didn't want to have an opinion. And then, but we did have a lot of support. And we thought that support, especially like the American Foundation for AIDS Research from MFAR, I mean, they had this first ever AIDS benefit in New York. And, you know, we were going to be able to go, and Ryan was going to do this event with Elizabeth Taylor. And I thought, you know, what a great educational tool, because here we were run up in this turmoil and discrimination, thinking that kissing, tears, sweat, and saliva spreaded AIDS, and mosquitoes and fleas might spread AIDS. And here we were going to an event where all these celebrities were, and they don't want to get AIDS. So we thought, what a great visual educational tool that was going to be, that, you know, you can't get AIDS by being around somebody. So I think once the celebrities and everything started coming forth, and they got involved. I mean, especially like with Elton John. I mean, Ryan went on Good Morning America, and I mean, we have no idea what's going to happen. Okay. And, David Hartman asked Ryan, he said, Ryan, who are you looking forward to meeting at this AIDS benefit? And Ryan says, meeting Elton John, definitely. Well, he come into the green room, and I said, Ryan, I said, why did you say Elton? And he said, because he's not afraid to be different. And so, I think within Ryan himself, he's like, you know, Elton stands out there, you know, and I'm going to stand out there too. And then it just being around so many people, and then the celebrities all start supporting Ryan.
I know Elton John's still a good family friend of yours, and he had to postpone his Indianapolis show this past weekend due to illness. Were you planning on seeing him when you were in town this weekend?
Oh, yes. I had 20 friends I was bringing. Elton gave me 20 tickets for some people that were around at that time, that were at the hospital those final days and so forth. So a lot of my family and friends were going, but we'll go again in March. We're just glad he's okay. I really worry about him. I know how hard it is for me to be on the road and, you know, all the traveling and I really worry about him, and I've told him that in many letters, but I just, you know, I think he's doing too much.
Well, yeah, the postponed date, and he was sick this past weekend, had to postpone the Indianapolis show and the new dates in March. And I understand that Ryan is mentioned a lot in Elton John's new autobiography that came out, I think, 2 weeks ago today. Did that surprise you, the amount of pages that were devoted to Ryan?
I don't know. I didn't know how he would tell the story. And, you know, he was in a quite a state at that time. I mean, and we had, the whole time we knew him, we saw him in and out different maybe programs. Or, you know, you it's kind of strange because sometimes when you'd go backstage, there would be liquor everywhere. And then sometimes you'd go and there wouldn't be no liquor anywhere. So you would kind of know the demons that maybe he was trying to, you know, work on himself. And so we kind of, we could kind of tell at certain times, not all the time, but we could tell even at the hospital, you could tell, you know, he had some issues but he tried to hide it. I mean, he tried to hide it around us, especially. He was always such a great person around us. I mean, you know, we just loved him to death, all of us.
And I know his now 29 years of sobriety started just after Ryan's funeral. How did you, I mean, did you know that part of it, that Ryan was such a big part of him getting sober?
Well, I tell you what, I saw at the hospital, Michael Jackson had called the hospital and he asked if he could speak to Ryan. And I said, Michael, he's in a coma. He won't be able to hear you. He said, no, he'll be able to hear me. I know he will. Is there any way you can get a telephone line ran? Well, Elton was getting everything done at the hospital. I mean, there wasn't a want or need that anybody didn't have. So we got a telephone line ran to Ryan's room, and Michael Jackson called the hospital, and Elton was talking to Michael. And I looked over at Elton. He had tears just running down his face. I've never seen that. I've never seen it with tears just running down his face. And I put my arm around him, and I said, what's the matter? And he said, you know, with all the money that's in this room, we can't bring this boy back to life. And that, he said, was a real realization to him. He had all the money he could ever buy or want, but he didn't have his health. And he kept mentioning that he did not have his health, you know. And so I kind of thought maybe this might be changing. And he was calling me. He got me a phone. He was calling me 3 and 4 times a day, you know, until he went into rehab. So up in Chicago. So, I didn't know when it would be happening, but I sure was hoping that it would happen and he would be saved. And so I really feel like he got a miracle through Ryan. And that's very, very rewarding to know that. Yeah, he's got his life back together. And then to have David is such a great person, and to have 2 beautiful children. I mean, I want to say it's just the neatest dream a person could have after being in the state that he was in.
And David being Elton John's husband.
Yes, partner. Yeah, his husband. So, but just I think that to see somebody's life change so much and then to have so much where money isn't everything, you know, that your personal life and your children and that part means so much, because that was always, I mean, my family, I mean, that's one thing Elton, he said, you know, you guys have such a neat family. I'm just so proud to be a part of it. And so it was a welcoming to have Elton a part of our family.
Back to the piece, Meryl, there was a lot of fear at that time, and there was misinformation about HIV and AIDS. Did anyone you caught up with for this share anything about that in retrospect?
Oh, man, there was, I think everybody I spoke with had something to say about that. You know, I think we forget now where we are, where, you know, HIV can be a very manageable health condition for, you know, people who have access to the right kind of medication, to regular health care, to regular checkups. All of that, of course, can be very expensive. But we have made such quick progress. I mean, not quick, but when you look at the grand scheme of things, it has been really fast how quickly things have changed. And, you know, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has been treating HIV patients from the very beginning, you know, before people even knew what this was, it was still this unnamed, mysterious disease. He spoke about, you know, that quick arc of history. And I think there's a bite from him as well.
Let's hear it.
During the time when we didn't have even a name for it, we called it GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency. We didn't have an agent until HIV discovered. We didn't have a diagnostic test. Then we didn't have a drug, and then we had drugs, and now we have many, many drugs. In the history of medicine, to go from almost totally, not quite, but almost totally lethal disease about which you knew nothing. You didn't even know what the cause was. 37 years later to today, when you not only have highly effective drugs and highly effective prevention modalities, but you can actually, if you implement that, can not only save the lives of people and eliminate suffering, but you might actually be able to end the epidemic.
And Merrill, you also talked to the lawyer who represented the parents who were fighting to keep Ryan out of school. How did he handle the attention he got?
Well, he was clearly traumatized by it. And I really had a lot of, it brought up a lot of feelings. Clearly, when we were talking about it, he talked about being represented in the television movie that was made about Ryan's life. He spoke at length about a lot of the hate mail that he was receiving after everything sort of settled on the legal side of things. And there's a bit of tape from that as well.
This went on daily for weeks and months, and it was just never ending. And it wasn't from Kokomo, Indiana. It was from Florida. It was from California. It was from Canada. It was from, all over. And, I wanted to go on media and say, hey, I did my job. Leave me alone. If you want to be upset with the law. The law says you can't send a child to school. Ryan can't go to school with HIV. Change the law. And they did. They did. But at that time, everybody who was upset with me should have been upset with the way the law was written at that time.
And how did he eventually reconcile with himself for the role he played?
Well, I think he was very clear that he was doing the work that he was hired for. So he had what he was presenting, a very literal interpretation of the law at that time. Somebody, a child with an infectious disease, cannot attend school. He, in his interview, was very matter of fact with me. That was the way that he interpreted it. And he noted too, at that time, the state, the health department knew so little about how to deal with a situation like this. They were learning in real time. And as he says at the end of that bite, the law changed. Health practices changed after this, but this was the first time Indiana, and I think really any of the 50 states, was going through something like this. But at the end of Ryan's life, David Rosslow did attend Ryan's services, and he spoke about that in the interview as well.
And Jeannie, let's move to the Ryan White Care Act. Just to get a little background, its first iteration was introduced to the Senate a month before Ryan passed. Were you involved at all in its language?
No, not the language or anything. I mean, Ryan was being covered by so much media at the time, during especially the last week and a half of the hospital stay. I mean, the media was camped out at Riley Hospital. The phones were just ringing off the hook. Everybody was wanting to know how he was doing and so forth. And so Elton was like anybody that was calling or coming, they were going through Elton. But Senator Kennedy called the hospital and asked to speak to me. And Elton told me, he said, Jeannie, this is the one, somebody you should talk to. And it was Senator Kennedy. And he said they were having these first hearings. He said, nobody has brought so much attention to this disease. He said, for the first time, we have people caring about people with AIDS now. He said, with your permission, we would like to name it the Ryan White Care Act. And I was just involved in so many things. I said, that would be nice. Never, ever realizing how enormous that bill would actually become and how the longevity of it and the fight to help people to live today and people can get their meds. So, I mean, I had no idea at the time, but Senator Kennedy and Hatch are the ones that really got me speaking after Ryan passed away, because it was just a few weeks after Ryan passed away that I get another call from Senator Kennedy. And I said, Ryan did that, not me. I said, they wanted me to come to D.C. And Senator Hatch was the one that kind of really named it the Ryan White Care Act, because he said we need to take the focus off of the disease, off the people who have the disease. Everybody has a mom. Let's represent all moms that are losing their children. And so they insisted really that I when I talk that I that me speak out, I guess, and treat the disease, you know, like a disease. And so I went to D.C. and I really didn't feel like I did great. But for the first time, I felt like I had a place in this or a role in this epidemic, too, by speaking out for mothers. And so, you know, and I've been doing it ever since. And it's been so rewarding to see this disease progress to where the people are undetectable. They can have children. Not transmit the disease. I mean, to see a disease from the very beginning and see us see people work so hard to try to get something, even for Ryan living 5.5 years in 1990. And then to see the meds start coming about and seeing so many people you know, respond to the disease. And now we, even though we don't have a cure.
We're spending the hour with Jeannie Whitegender. I'm afraid we have a quick break to take, but she's the mother of Ryan White, the Indiana teenager who helped change the conversation around AIDS. Up next, more on the Ryan White Care Act. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our conversation with producer Merrill Agish from PBS's Retro Report, and Jeannie Whitegender, mother of Ryan White. Of course, we'll take your questions and comments in this final segment with our guests. Does AIDS still get the attention it deserves? Do HIV patients get enough support? If not, how can we do better? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Merrill, I want to come back to you. You heard from health professionals about the importance of the Ryan White Care Act. What did they say about what would happen if it went away?
Oh, man. Well, if I think a lot of the credit to the progress we've made, you know, extends from the Ryan White Care Act. So if it were to go away, you know, there's great potential that we could go right back to where we started. The 1980s feels like a very, you know, it's very far in the past, but we could be right back there again. And in my interview with Dr. Cox from Riley Children, she spoke about this exact topic.
I think the effect of the Ryan White Care Act were to not be renewed at some point or to go away would be devastating. There would be so many people who could not get therapy, who could not be enrolled, who could not see a doctor, that we would see those images of suffering that we saw back in the 80s. All over again. You know, I think it's important to remember that in sub-Saharan Africa, a huge percentage of people are infected with HIV, and they've lost an entire generation because they cannot get care. And so it can easily become, again, a terminal illness that's really a death sentence if we don't stay on top of it. And to stay on top of it, we have to have people in care, and we have to have people delivering that care, and we can't do that if there's not funding.
And Merrill, in your piece, we will hear about how even today there's a lot of misinformation that might guide at-risk or HIV-positive people down the wrong path. Do you have a sense of what some of that is and why it's out there?
I think a lot of the stigma around HIV, you know, is very deeply ingrained. And a lot of the issues that people were dealing with, you know, that somebody like Ryan was dealing with back in the 80s, a lot of our young people still deal with similar fears and worries that if they come out as being HIV positive, they may be shunned by their peers. They may be, you know, kicked out by their families even. And I spent some time in Jacksonville, Florida, which has one of the highest rates of new HIV diagnoses in the entire country, filming at a queer youth center and organization down there. And I met with some young people who were talking about, you know, all the misinformation that they were trying to combat among their peers and among their family. So it's hard to get away from some of these tropes. You know, there's still a lot of fear around being HIV positive.
And these are often people who are vulnerable members of society. If it weren't for HIV, the LGBTQ community, people of color, people from poorer areas, since education on these problems is so important. Is that kind of the main purpose of this infrastructure set forth by the Ryan White Care Act, getting the information to the communities that need it?
Well, it's getting the information out there, but most critically, it's getting people who have no other means to get into care, So the Ryan White Care System, you know, it's the payer of last resort. So if somebody does not have any access to insurance in states where Medicaid has not been expanded, it's an especially critical part of the infrastructure. So a young person, for instance, who is getting an HIV positive diagnosis, who doesn't have the means to get medication, you know, the future looks very different than somebody who within a few days, even within a day, can get started on HIV medication and can go down that path of living, you know, a long, healthy, hopefully, fulfilling life. That there are just so many different options out there. And the key part of it is getting access to care.
Jeannie, the Ryan White Care Act was reauthorized a number of times. How involved were you whenever that would come back up? Did you ever find yourself feeling like you had to fight the same battle over and over again?
Well, I think so. I think that, you know, you continuously have a younger generation coming up that, you know, don't believe that AIDS can affect or infect them. I mean, I know, especially now in the South, you know, we're in the South, of Hispanic and African-American numbers are so high. And it's because people don't want to go public. They're afraid of who might find out. They're afraid of losing their families. They're, and especially within the church, the religious communities, we're kind of back to where we were years ago, because people are being infected and they're not wanting to go into treatment because they're afraid that somebody will find out that they have AIDS. But trying to talk to people, ensure people that get into treatment. You know, you can be, you can have children. You can be close to zero detectable. And I mean, just to emphasize people, this is so you can live. You can live now with AIDS. You don't have to die. You don't have to hide. Just get into treatment.
The program still remains. This might seem like a silly question asking you, but how important is it for Congress to keep funding it?
Well, from what I see, we have a grantee meeting every other year, and it's coming up this August. HRSA has just announced that. And that you really see what's going on all across the United States. You know, this, you see the needs, you see the demands, that, and that's how we decide what monies are going to go where. It's hope. It's really, we want to end this epidemic. And if we can get people to be undetectable, then we're going to be able to get to zero. But that number is just getting people in to be tested. It's just that is the hardest part, is if you're at risk, if you've had multiple partners, please get in to get tested, because your life is going to be able to be saved. And Ryan's wasn't.
We're talking about the legacy of Ryan White with producer Meryl Agish from PBS's Retro Report and the mother of Ryan White, Jeannie White-Ginder. She's on the phone. Jeannie, let's talk about ending the epidemic. President Trump announced earlier this year in his State of the Union address an effort to end the HIV epidemic by 2030. Do you think that's possible?
I think if we don't lose any funding for Ryan White, maybe. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's just a matter of education and getting to the areas that are having newer numbers, and talking to people about getting them into to care and getting them into to and educating them about the meds. You know, and you don't have to. You know, you can live a practically a normal life again. I mean, just you don't have to be scared. You can get into treatment. I think we can end it by 2030. I just hope that, you know, we definitely can't if we don't have the Ryan White continuing, because people without insurance and stuff will not be able to seek treatment.
Here's an inspiring message from Kevin from Facebook. He says, I was at Riley going through chemo at the same time Ryan was there. I did get to meet him, and he helped to inspire me to overcome my disease. There were a lot of kids battling all kinds of illnesses, and as you can imagine, just as many emotional responses to their illnesses. Ryan always displayed hope. I did survive, and I now take my children to the museum to see Ryan's exhibit. Thank you, Ryan. What's it like to hear? You must have heard things like that a million times, but what's it like to hear that?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's good because I've seen so many kids worry more about their parents. Like the kids at Riley or the kids at any hospital who are going through such hard times with their health, they worry more about their parents, I think, that how they're going to deal with it than they worry about themselves. As long, you know, it's so neat to know that these parents are going to be with their child no matter what. And I think that's just having that ability to be able, as a parent, to just always make sure your child knows that, you know, they're always going to be there for them. And that's an insurance I think kids really need today.
And Merrill, you talk to people from Riley Hospital for Children here in Indianapolis who still remember Ryan being there. What did they say about him?
That he still is this very real presence, you know, so many years after his death, that the effect of somebody like him having been treated at Riley, having been, you know, such a figure for those 5.5 years that he was in treatment there, that his legacy still really lives on. And he's the type of person that they still look to for inspiration, you know, when they're treating, you know, children with all kinds of illnesses, as that listener said, that he's still very much there.
And we heard a little from Kevin from Facebook about the exhibit. What's there at Riley today that commemorates his presence there?
Well, when I was there, there was some renovation going on. So the large installation of Ryan's face was actually under wraps, so I couldn't get to see it. But as we went touring around, you know, Dr. Cox was a resident while Ryan was in treatment those last weeks of his life. And she spoke about how it really changed the course of her own career. She hadn't been planning necessarily to go into HIV/AIDS at the time she was a resident, but seeing Ryan, seeing Dr. Martin Kleinman being right there by his side, you know, really had this profound effect on the arc of her career. And now, 30 years later, she's still in this area of medical care, and she's, you know, now high up at Riley. So you can see how he really had this incredible impact on people who, you know, came into his orbit at that time.
Jeannie, back to the plan that the president announced earlier this year in his State of the Union address to end the epidemic by 2030. Are you aware of some of the details of this plan?
No, not right now. No, I will know more, I think, in August when we have the All Titles Conference.
Were you surprised at that announcement in the State of the Union address?
No, I mean, I think everybody's been really working on this. I mean, I think every president has wanting to have a future, a goal of a set date that we want to try to be at, you know, to end this epidemic. I think we've all been kind of doing this for several years. But to actually hear it being said, I think that's a good progress to be made. It gets everybody working. It gets everybody to have that goal of working all together, and this is the end accomplishment. We want to do it by here, you know, instead of just having it hang on. Well, maybe next year. This gives us a goal to be set.
Merrill, this announcement earlier this year came after a tumultuous year and a half. Several members of the president's HIV/AIDS Advisory Council quit in 2017. There was an op-ed in Newsweek written by one of the council members who quit entitled "Trump Doesn't Care About HIV, We're Out of Here." Do you know, you mentioned the efforts in the intro to your piece that's going to air tonight. Do you know how we got from there in 2017 when all of these advisory people quit to where we are now with this big effort from the administration?
Well, I can't speak to, you know, the internal politics and what exactly was happening within these different groups. But, you know, in speaking with Dr. Fauci, who is very central to this plan, this is a goal that has become more and more realistic to launch over recent years. And I think all these different health agencies got to a point where they realized, you know, we can actually do this. And if you look to places like New York City and San Francisco, they're ahead of schedule for something like this, that it is within the realm of the possible to really end the HIV epidemic. So it's going to take a lot of work to do that on a national level, because there are just so many health disparities, so many different, it's very uneven, the landscape across this country. So in some places we may get there sooner, but as a national goal, I think from the health agency side, at least, it seemed like this is something that could actually done with the, you know, everything working together, all the funding in place there, all the different services working in alignment. It really is, a tremendous effort, but it's incredible that we're at a point now where on a national level, we can be talking about ending the HIV epidemic, you know, within a decade. That's kind of mind blowing when you think about where we started back in the early 80s.
Jeannie, a few years ago, I wouldn't have understood why someone who's been through everything that you've been through would want to continue this kind of advocacy for the rest of their life. And then I had kids. I get it now. But there have to be times when it's still hard. Is it still difficult sometimes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my most insecure moments, I think, are here at home with my husband. I mean, the things that flash back in your mind and your heart that just makes you just, you know, want to just cry and just like, why us, you know, why Ryan? But at the same time, Ryan always had a smile on his face. I mean, he never said like, why me? And so when I go to the Children's Museum and I get to share Ryan's story, it's kind of therapy. I mean, I'm so fortunate that I can talk about Ryan and people want to know more about him, where it kind of keeps him alive within me. And a lot of people don't have that. And that's one thing I want to very much share with everybody is communicate with some about people who have passed away, because they're part of your life. They're part of your family. I'm more fortunate, yes, but I encourage all families to try to do that, because whether it be mom or dad or a sibling or somebody that's passed away, it's, you know, I think it needs to be brought out. And the tears, there's nothing wrong with tears, and there's nothing wrong with crying and people being sad, but it also brings up a lot of joyous moments, because, I mean, when people share their stories with me, with Ryan, about him speeding his car down 37, you know, or something like that, you know, you just still want to hear those moments. I mean, Ryan wasn't perfect, but all the memories that we had, it's just, you know, no one can take them away. I ended up scrapbooking all Ryan's life, and I have 42 scrapbooks, and the Children's Museum has them now. But that really helped me to relive and, you know, like, understand, like, the difference he made. Because as we're living every day, I mean, we're saying, thank you, Lord, for another day, and we had many days to be thankful for. But also, it's kind of a blur, you know, but you want to remember all them great memories. And I have the privilege that I can do that through the Children's Museum.
I want to thank you both so much for your time today. Jeannie White-Ginder, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you as well, Meryl Agish from PBS's Retro Report. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Meryl's piece on Ryan White airs tonight on tonight's edition of Retro Report, which starts at 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get podcasts. Join us next time when we'll be talking about Indiana's haunted house attractions. We'll also talk to psychologists about why we love to be scared. And in the meantime, feel free to share where you love to go every year and why you like it. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pilser. Thanks for listening today. This is All In.